I'm Neil Ferguson, the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and Chair of the Hoover History Working Group. This week, we've been lucky to be joined by Eric Schlussel, an Assistant Professor of History and International Affairs at George Washington University, who's come to talk about his new book, Land of Strangers, just published by Columbia University Press. Eric works on what once would have been considered an obscure corner of the People's Republic of China, as it now is, Xinjiang, or East Turkestan. But it's no longer so obscure because of the increasingly controversial policies being pursued in Xinjiang by the Chinese government. So it's extraordinarily timely and exciting to have an expert on Xinjiang's history to come and explain to us some of the background of this extraordinary and unfamiliar part of the world. So Eric, I want to begin by asking a general question, really. The 19th century was an age of empires wherever one looked, and all these empires had borderlands, and these borderlands were places where the dominant imperial people tried to impose their culture on the local or indigenous people. Is Xinjiang just another story of colonization on the periphery, or are there things that make it special?
Well, that's a great question, because when I was looking through the archives and trying to figure out what was happening really in Xinjiang in the late 19th century, I thought that I would find a unique story. But as I looked through the stories of everyday people, I found, wow, this looks a lot like colonialism. Not only in terms of the policies that are being articulated, it looks so much like the later history of British India and other places, but in terms of the effects on the ground. Now, what's distinct about this, in part, is that it doesn't have a Western genealogy. That is to say, this whole civilizing project, this effort to transform Muslims into Confucians, really comes out of the stuff of Chinese ideology and Chinese ideas. And that, I think, is fascinating because it shows that colonialism can appear in different times and different places.
Give us a little bit of context. Late Qing China is an empire reassembling itself after an enormously traumatic event, the Taiping Rebellion, which is in many ways the biggest conflict of the world seas in the 19th century. Try and help me understand the relationship between that great upheaval and what then ensues in Xinjiang after the Taiping are suppressed.
We should always think about the Taiping as one of the great motivating forces of modern Chinese history. Much as we think of the Civil War and its reconstruction in America as the conflict that made America into the society it is today, we're still living with the consequences of reconstruction. So it was in China. This army and its leadership from Hunan province, this new modern army, is famous for having beaten back the Taiping, but then they continued their mission. They tried to remake that society into a stronger one by changing people's family values, by making stronger families, by trying to teach people how to be good Confucians. And then they brought that same project into the Northwest. Now, the Taiping Civil War had fragmented China proper, but in the Northwest, Muslim groups had also rebelled against the Qing Empire, and the empire had lost control in that entire region. These leaders of this army, the Xiang Army, believed that the loss of control in the Northwest had the same causes as the loss of control under the Taiping, no family values. And so once they conquered the Northwest in these Muslim regions, including Xinjiang, they took the experience of the Taiping War and the Taiping Reconstruction and tried to replicate the experiment in the Northwest among culturally very different people. So I really see it as part of one broader process. Historians tend to think of Xinjiang as something unique, something sui generis, as a borderland that stands among it on its own. And there's even an attempt these days to make a field of Xinjiang studies, but I think my project shows that this emergent colonialism has everything to do with the broader conflicts of the 19th century Qing.
Now, one of the things that strikes me as an historian is that you're taking on some pretty tricky source materials in trying to reconstruct the history of this particular imperial borderland. And I want to give you an opportunity to brag about your linguistic prowess, because you needed not only Mandarin, but also Chagatai, Turkic, and what other languages went into this project?
So I'll begin with the big puzzle about doing Xinjiang history, and that's that the Chinese sources come from a minority of Chinese people ruling the region, and they mostly say things about what those few people thought. But then you have sources in Uyghur and in Chagatai, which is the pre-modern version of the Uyghur language. I happen to have authored a textbook for the Chagatai language. If you read these, they tell you a lot about local society, Muslim thought, Muslim culture, but they don't tell you much about their interactions with the state. So I had this puzzle of how to unify these two sets of sources. One of the ways I did that was to learn Swedish and read the records of Swedish missionaries, which were really enlightening because they talk about both sides of the equation. They helped me pose new questions that led me to look at the Chagatai and Chinese sources in new ways. Fortunately, the archive of this one oasis, the oasis of Turpan in eastern Xinjiang, is also available to scholars. And so with these questions in mind, I could dive into that archive, which was paleographically sadistic, but ultimately very rewarding, to try and understand, for example, how did translation work between these two languages? How do people navigate these two cultures? How would you represent one thing in Chagatai and another in Chinese? And by trying to tease out that relationship, that politics of translation, it opened up all of these new avenues of inquiry.
One of the things that you taught me was the rather different way in which the Qing authorities and Qing officials thought about marriage between different ethnic groups. In some empires, that was becoming more or less taboo. But in fact, the story in Xinjiang is different. They actually wanted Han Chinese soldiers to settle down and marry Uyghur women. Have I got that right?
Yes, you have. And that was another big surprise. You know, I opened up the archives and I got to the section of the local archive that deals with marriage, education, and smallpox vaccination. It's all in one section. The first volume was full of nothing but cases about forced marriage and kidnapping and basically sex trafficking. I try to figure out what was causing this, what's going on here. And well, what I hadn't realized was that, yes, you're quite right. The army leadership that reconquered Xinjiang didn't trust their own soldiers. They thought that all these unmarried men, who in China you'd call them bear sticks, that these bachelors were a dangerous force of imminent violence who were just going to disrupt the new society that they were trying to build. They also thought the Muslim women were simply sexually promiscuous and similarly disruptive. It's almost a Jeffersonian idea. You know, they really thought that they could settle wild men and wild women together, and that the marriage relationship, this is very Confucian, would lead them to civilize each other as they farmed and engaged in good, honest work on the frontier. And that would make the desert bloom. That encouraged sex trafficking, ironically. This is definitely not the effect that they were going for, because that's actually something that they'd tried to stop in China proper. But out in the borderland, they're so concerned with stability that they just wanted to make as many marriages as possible.
Well, I don't want to do a violence to history, but I'm going to skip out a great chunk of time between the late 19th century and the present, and ask you to talk a little bit about how some similar processes, but I use the word similar advisedly, are in underway in Xinjiang today. We know that the Chinese government is pursuing a very aggressive policy of forced cultural assimilation. Some would say it is technically genocide, because they appear to be obliterating the culture of the Uyghur people. I think we need a historian at this point to compare and contrast these two different episodes in assimilation.
So it's interesting. When I first thought about this project, I think it was in a seminar with Lynn Struve at Indiana University in 2007, long time ago, I was thinking about this project. It seemed so alien and strange. In 2004, 2005, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region did begin an explicit program to eliminate the Uyghur language from public education. However, you know, until quite recently, the overall ideology of the Chinese state in Xinjiang said that the legitimacy of the state was based on economic development, and by raising a standard of living, people would naturally come to join in the state project and feel themselves to be more Chinese, and they would abandon separate ethnic identities, and they would let go of religion. And so when I began this project in 2007, I thought, okay, it's funny that right now the state is so focused on economy, hard material conditions. But when you look back at the late 19th century, they were mainly explicitly concerned with people's minds and hearts. How strange is this? Well, that all changed in 2016, 2017, with the arrival of Chen Quanguo, the new party secretary of Xinjiang, who, following a certain amount of violence that's been construed as terrorism, and with Xi Jinping's explicit blessing, began a project to, as he puts it, cure people, cleanse people of spiritual pollution from the outside. Now, there's certainly a kind of harmony there. The standards by which a Uyghur person is now judged in terms of spiritual pollution are whether or not they seem Chinese. And that perception of Chineseness is based on what I call sinonormativity, an intuitive sense of what Chineseness is. So Uyghurs suspect unless they do all the things your average Joe Schmo would do in China, smoke, drink, watch TV, things like this. People have even been sent to re-education camps for not watching pornography, which is technically illegal. Similarly, in the late 19th century, the project of assimilation was also based on this intuitive sense of Chineseness that was based on a few elite values that most Chinese people probably didn't even explicitly practice, but had to be implemented in Xinjiang. So I think there is a harmony there between these two sorts of projects. I think they both also reflect a state that is struggling to mobilize all of its people and bring them into a common project. That's a crisis that certainly faced the late Qing, and it's a crisis that faces the Chinese state today. Now, I'll just simply point out, of course, there's one major difference. The contemporary Chinese state has it as its command one of the world's largest economies and a massive technologically sophisticated surveillance state that definitely did not exist in the 19th century. So we have to be judicious in our comparison.
I do like your point, though, that it's empires in a weakened state that often attempt this kind of homogenization, whereas empires at the peak of their power are a good deal more tolerant of diversity on the periphery. I really find that insightful, and it tallies with research that I've done on very different empires in very different parts of the world. Eric, Land of Strangers is a fascinating book. I've read the introduction. I'm eager to read more. But let me give you a chance to talk a little bit about your next project. What are you working on now?
I was doing a lot of things, but right now I'm most excited because I'm finishing a translation of the preeminent Uyghur history of the Uyghur homeland, and that is Mulla Musa Sayyarami's Tarikh-i Hamidi. It's a history not just of the 19th century and all the things that are talked about in Land of Strangers from the perspective of someone who lived through all of it and was on the ground and intimately involved, but it's also a meditation on the nature of power, of Chinese power in a Muslim context, and of the history of the world from the perspective of someone living in the region. So I can't wait to get that out in English and bring it for the first time to a global audience so we can have another important Uyghur voice in the discourse about this region's past.
Well, Eric, I must say that it's just incredibly great timing that we have a scholar with your gifts able to educate us about the history of Xinjiang and the roots of Uyghur culture at a time when the Uyghurs are under such intense pressure from the regime in Beijing. This is the kind of applied history that I'm most passionate about, and we're really delighted to have been able to welcome you to the Hoover Institution. We wish you the very best of luck, not only with Land of Strangers, but also with this fascinating sounding translation. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you very much.